This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, published in 1859, is arguably the most important and influential single book in the history of science. We're talking today with Simon DeDeo, external faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute and professor at Carnegie Mellon, about the decades-long process by which Darwin came to write it. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
This whole idea of evolution and natural selection in the book On the Origin of Species represents a huge creative leap in human thinking. It was enormously influential, not only on science, but society itself. What was that leap? What did the world look like before Darwin and the theories of evolution and natural selection?
So in many ways, what Darwin did in The Origin was put together a puzzle that had been sitting sort of on the floor for maybe even 100 years beforehand. Different people had different parts of what would end up being in his masterwork. And what Darwin was able to do was to see how the very longest timescales of the history of the Earth could be put together with a story about the origin of the variety that we see in the natural world. There was, at the point in time when Darwin was writing, nobody, at least in the scientific community and in the general intellectual public, nobody believed that God had made the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. No one believed that anymore. But there was a huge resistance, a huge inability to imagine that it all had come from an unintelligent process, that it had come, that the species had emerged in the world in a way that to us would have seemed the product of random variation. There was a huge resistance to that. There was a comfort with the idea that maybe God took a back seat, but there was still this reluctance and perhaps you might even say a failure of imagination to see how it could have been done entirely without some kind of master plan sitting somewhere written down in the heavens.
So there was still, it was kind of like in between the idea that there was no God at all directing things and that God made the whole thing in 6 days. It was kind of like a hybrid between those two things. Let's keep God in the mix, but look for natural, scientifically demonstrable causes.
I think that's right. So in the end, as human beings, we're pretty good at producing hybrid explanations. We are happy to go to the doctor, and we're also happy to try a miracle cure once in a while. We're pragmatists. Most of us are day to day. We believe in Newton's laws until we start driving. So it's not surprising that most people occupied a middle ground somewhere between biblical literalism and what today we would consider scientific naturalism, the idea that every phenomenon that we see, everything that we experience can be explained without reference to a creator. Most people were happy to do their science, to do their philosophy even, somewhere in this gray zone where they could attribute some things to impersonal natural laws, but other things they were willing to put off onto a creator, somebody who had a design for that system that either they couldn't explain or perhaps was even irrelevant or ancillary to their primary interests.
One of the things that you said a moment ago was about time scale. Over a very, very long period of time, life evolved, life changed. And what's one of the things that's so interesting to me about Darwin was the deep connection between observation of geology and observation of biological life.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of Darwin's major influences was the geologist Lyell. Lyell was one of the first people to describe the origin of geological features, the origins of mountains and rivers, the origins of islands and even continents. Lyell was one of the first people to describe that in a way that didn't make reference to a divine plan. It's fair to say that before Lyell really put together his account, most geologists, most scientists had a sense that the Earth was put together sort of like baking a cake, right? There were these eras, but they were incredibly structured eras. Certain things were laid down at certain points. The mountains were put in here, the rivers were put in there. And it was all tending towards the realization of a divine plan. The positions of the continents, the nature of the landscape we inhabited was like a wedding cake. It was something that had been constructed perhaps over a long time, but had been constructed in phases, and those phases made sense. Lyell, by contrast, was one of the first people to propose the idea that in this incredibly long span that we were beginning to realize the Earth had existed in, that the variation, the structure we see, the mountains that we see, the deserts, the landscapes that we see, that those had been produced by a process of gradual, mostly random, and incredibly gradual variation. And I think that's what really struck people. It's possible to imagine something not changing for a very long time. And I think that's the image that people had before Lyell, that there were these eras. And so occasionally something major would happen, some event, divinely ordained, would come in and do something and make a mountain. What was stunning about what Lyell was asking his readers to do, and Lyell was one of the major influences on Darwin, what was stunning about what Lyell asked his readers to do was to imagine these incredibly long time scales, centuries, millennia going by, and very tiny effects happening day by day, inch by inch, slowly raising mountains up. It's the difference between looking at a painting and watching a film in incredible slow motion. And the second thing was something that nobody had really been able to do before the era that Darwin found himself in, certainly, and that Lyell did as well.
And so then Darwin, and you can see sometimes in places like when he was on his great world voyage, there are moments where he could see, in a way that you probably couldn't have in England, those layers of rock that represented time. So was his great insight, I mean, okay, so we understand this about geology, that this also applies to life, like that kind of gradual change over time?
Exactly. I think maybe Lyell would be a great example of somebody who went halfway, who left the idea of a 6-day creation myth long behind, but could not get all the way to the point where Darwin ended up in 1859 when he wrote Origin of the Species. And in particular, Lyell could imagine this gradual process of geological change, but he absolutely refused, at least at that time, he absolutely refused to believe that it could apply to living species. Lyell could not accept what at the time was called the transmutation of species, the idea that one type of creature could turn into another. Lyell absolutely rejected that. Years later, Lyell actually becomes a great defender of Darwin's work, but at the time that Lyell was writing his major two-volume work on geology, which Darwin read, he had a partial theory of the world, one that Darwin himself acknowledged would be one of the major influences on his pattern of thinking.
We're talking to Simon DeDeo about Charles Darwin and the Origin of Species. There's this big question was, and this is something that you've been studying, writing papers about, what was Darwin's process? It's a scientific process of observation and discovery. It's also, in a way, a kind of a creative process, bringing into being something that wasn't there before, or putting together, as you say, pieces of the puzzle, seeing patterns, which some people say is like the essence of creativity, seeing patterns that hadn't been seen before. How did he get to that? Did he have a goal for his life? Did he see there's something missing or there's something wrong that he needed to correct? What did that look like?
If you asked someone to point out who would write the greatest scientific work of the 19th century and perhaps the greatest scientific work of the last 1,000 years, Darwin would be the last person you would pick, certainly in his youth. when he was a young man, Darwin loved hunting. He loved fishing. He loved being in the outdoors. He was the son of a very wealthy father. He came from a family. In fact, one of his grandfathers was Josiah Wedgwood, the entrepreneur who brought China to Britain, the porcelain to Britain. Darwin was a man who enjoyed life, is probably the simplest way to say it in his youth. He wanted to be outdoors. He wanted to see the world as it was. He loved observing what was around him. And in fact, over the course of his life, certainly up until the point when he takes this major voyage, when he goes and joins the expedition to the South Americas, to Southeast Asia on the voyage of the Beagle, certainly that's part of Darwin's early encounter with the natural world. And it's an encounter that is influenced by books, is influenced by science, but I think begins in just a love of seeing, love of shooting, a love of riding horses, a love of running with dogs. So in terms of the image we have of the scientist as a very serious young man, certainly Darwin doesn't fit that picture at all. It's perhaps when he begins medical school in Edinburgh in the early 19th century, in 1817. When he's up there, he's training to be a doctor. He has some intelligence, it's clear, but when he gets to Edinburgh and he sees the operation rooms, when he sees the big demonstrations, which is how they used to teach medicine, they would do an operation in front of a hall full of students, and they would do those operations without anesthetic. Darwin
Oh my
saw
goodness.
these, he saw an one of his great biographers, Janet Brown, describes Darwin attending an operation on a child and being so disgusted, in fact, that for the rest of his life he was unable to stand the sight of blood. So this is maybe not the most promising beginning for a biologist, being unable to look at a bleeding creature, even a bleeding human creature. The state of medicine at that time was bizarre, and in fact, even though it was done without anesthetic, we may have even had the technology to use anesthetic then, but the medical profession was so conservative that they didn't even see that some of the things that we could have used, like nitrous oxide, they didn't even see that those could actually be used to numb someone during an operation. It was entirely for entertainment purposes only. So Darwin's in Edinburgh. He's attempting to become a medical student. He's trying to buckle down and do something with his life after having a good time as an adolescent. And when he gets to Edinburgh, he realizes that he just can't do it. He can't be a doctor. The lectures, when they're not horrifying, they're incredibly dull. And so when he's there, he gets his first taste of the beginning of what is going to be a scientific revolution in the United Kingdom, which is the shift from what we would call today natural theology, the idea that one does science in order to discover the workings of God and everything, to something today that we would see as modern science, the idea that your job as a scientist is to come up with explanations for phenomena that you see, not to show how the phenomena you see somehow ratify a divine plan or speak to the glory of God. In Edinburgh, the university is a mess. It's somewhat of a free market system where students don't actually sign on to become a student. They simply pay lecture by lecture for what they want to attend. But what he does discover in Edinburgh is a number of free-thinking men, scientists who, unable to do their work at the more conservative universities like Oxford and Cambridge, have come to Edinburgh to study what is going to be the scientific basis upon which Darwin is going to build his theory 40 years later.
And then at a certain point, he goes on this 5-year-long voyage, which was really the basis of the rest of his life's work. Is that right?
Exactly. And again, Darwin is picked for this voyage. He's joining the captain. This is a naval expedition, essentially. Its job is to finish some of the surveying that's been done on an expedition that had just returned.
So they're like making maps and stuff like that.
They're making maps. They're checking up on the locals in the different places they end up visiting. They start in St. Helena. They end up down in South America. They make the voyage around the Cape into Australia and Tasmania. They're doing the job that the British Navy is going to get increasingly better at in the 19th century, which is essentially monitoring the world.
Yeah.
They're making maps, but they're also getting intelligence on the nature of the local economies. They're trying to understand the relationships that British citizens have in the various places they visit to the local peoples. They're gathering botanical specimens in part to fill the research laboratories back in England, but also to see if there's anything of commercial value. The voyage that Darwin joined, the voyage of the Beagle, of the HMS Beagle, had a large number of not quite incompatible goals. In many ways, it's somewhat like the voyage of the Starship Enterprise. They're not quite sure what they're doing. They're probably exploring. They have a couple things on the list, but as the captain makes his voyage, for example, he's able to extend it additional years as he decides that there's more things that he wants to do. And there's no radio contact that he has back with the Admiralty. And so he's essentially making decisions on the basis of what he thinks is a good idea. And that basis includes the study of the natural world. What's funny is that Darwin is picked for this voyage. He's asked to join this voyage not because he's a particularly good scientist. He's still quite young
He's
at
like
this.
a little young 20-something.
He's in his early 20s, exactly. He's just finished Cambridge. He's trying to figure out what to do next. And he's picked because Fitzroy is a depressive. He's a man with psychological troubles, and he wants a friend on the voyage, and he wants, in particular, a friend of his own social class. Darwin's a wealthy young man. Fitzroy is a senior member of the British Navy, and so that's how Darwin gets his berth in the ship. He's not even officially the ship's naturalist. He's there in part just to have conversations with Fitzroy. And on the side, Darwin's excited because he gets to see countries, he gets to see landscapes, he gets to collect biological specimens, which by this point in time has become a passion for him. He's switched from shooting partridges to collecting beetles. That's when, after he dropped out of medical school, he formed a passion for beetles. But even so, actually, he's not the official naturalist on board. The Navy already has somebody whose job it is to do all of that. And so Darwin has basically no purpose on board except the purpose he chooses to make for himself.
So what he does on this ship is keeps extensive notes and journals, which become the basis of the rest of his life's work and also change how he sees the world and life and these species that he's been examining.
Darwin falls in love with the natural world all over again. He's become an incredibly good observer of the landscape in his native home in the United Kingdom. He's the local expert on the beetles that can be found in the bottom of the punts in Cambridge. But when he goes on this voyage, which is something that is going to give him experiences that he can barely imagine when he sets out. When he goes on this voyage, what strikes him again and again, and what shows up in his journals, and then what shows up indeed in The Origin of Species, his great work, is the incredible diversity of the natural world. Darwin is somebody who can take it all in. He can see what he later would come to call the tangled bank, right? On the side of a river, there is the roots of a tree, there are the worms, there are the fish, there are the birds that eat the worms, there's the moss, there's the lichens. There's so many things happening, even in the smallest patch of land. And Darwin is being thrown into a series of environments that even today have no equal for their biological diversity. So as he's absorbing this environment, he is indeed taking extraordinarily good notes. He's preserving specimens. He's constantly shipping things back home. And his friend back in the United Kingdom is sort of taking all these boxes and putting notes on them. Because what is he doing, right? He's shooting birds. He's taking birds. He's finding fossils. He discovers a new species, one of the early discoveries in his life that he takes great pride in. He discovers a new species of bird. The problem is that it's on the ship and the sailors have already gotten halfway through eating it. So he can only preserve part of it, which he ships back to the United Kingdom. Ironically, the thing that we know Darwin best for, or his experience on the voyage of the Beagle that we know him best for, is the Galapagos finches. These birds that he discovers or encounters on the Galapagos Islands, which are in the Pacific Ocean. In later works, and certainly in the 20th century, these become the paradigmatic story for how evolution works. The birds on different islands begin to adapt to the local conditions, to the weather that they encounter in these separate places. And as they adapt, they change their form and become, in the end, different species. Now, what's hilarious about this is that when Darwin is actually on the Beagle, and when he does get to the Galapagos, he captures a bunch of these finches, but he kind of puts them in a bag and he doesn't even label them. And it's only later, when he gets back to the United Kingdom, that he realizes that he might have an important part of the story that he needs, and he gets a friend of his to try to figure out where on earth these finches came from. So the one point in time, or one of the points in time, where he really needs good notes, he doesn't actually have them.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. So then when he gets back to England and spends the next 20 years reading, writing, researching, what is the process that he uses? I mean, he's not a professor in a university, right, who has to teach classes. He's sort of a gentleman scientist at this point.
Exactly. So he returns from this voyage. He writes an account of it, which we now call The Voyage of the Beagle. It had a very dull title when it was first published. But his account of what he's experienced is not philosophically radical. It's not a conceptual revision of the way we understand biology. This is much too early in his career for that to happen. But it is an incredibly good book. It's a book that is talking about the geology of the lands that he encounters. It's a book that's talking about the biology of the lands he encounters. It's also a book that talks about the human geography, the kinds of people that he encounters on his trip. And Darwin tries to answer, at least wrestles with some of the questions, and these were questions that were certainly open for Victorians at the time, wrestles with some of the questions like, well, are people from outside of Europe, are they really people, or are they just kind of a different species? So Darwin's wrestling with all those questions. He's writing about them. And that book that comes out, the papers, the scientific papers that he delivers on the subjects that he's encountered, make his name as a young man of promise. And so within a few years after he's come back from this voyage, he's come back in some sense a changed man. He left as somebody who wasn't quite sure what he was going to do with his life. He had talents, but he had nothing to show for it. When he comes back from this voyage, he's matured intellectually, he's matured emotionally. His companionship with Fitzroy was probably part of that, although Darwin was always, it turns out, always an incredibly pleasant man, or at least that's how people talk about him in their own memories of him. But when Darwin gets back, very soon he's elected to membership in the Royal Society, which is Britain's major scientific society. He becomes a member of the Athenaeum, which is one of the major clubs for discussion. It's at the center, essentially, a British intellectual life. Darwin doesn't have to work for a living. He makes money, of course, off the sale of these books, including Voyage of the Beagle, but these are never bestsellers. At this point in time, he's living off his family money, but at the same time, he now has a career in life. He has something that he's doing with himself.
And he starts reading, in a very, I think, strategic way. And this is something, again, that you have written about. He reads and takes notes, and these notes have come down to us.
Exactly. Darwin was, today we would call him a life hacker, sort of in the tradition of someone like Benjamin Franklin. He, despite his genial nature, was somebody who was constantly observing the world around him and observing his own self. And when he returns from the voyage, he's already accumulated a great deal of reading, which we have records of. And over the next 20, 30 years of his life, he continues to take extremely good notes on the books that he's read, what he finds inside of them, the dates in which he read them. Darwin is somebody who is, at the same time that he's building a theory based fundamentally on observations of the natural world, is simultaneously making observations of himself and leaving behind a record that, for those of us interested in the psychology of creativity, those of us interested in how people make something where there was nothing before, how people create a work as important as The Origin of the Species, what's exciting is that Darwin left us an enormous amount of data from which we can now try to understand how he was able to do what he did.
We're talking to Simon DeDeo about Charles Darwin. You've come up with some language to describe Darwin's process that has to do with staying close to home first in terms of your intellectual pursuits and then sort of going further afield. What does that look like?
Right. So when we came to look at the records that Darwin had left behind, and this is work that we did with Jamie Murdoch, who is a graduate student in cognitive science at Indiana University, and then also Colin Allen, who is professor of cognitive science and also in the Department of the History of Science, also at Indiana. When we first came to look at these records, we began, appropriately enough, I would say, with a biological metaphor. Darwin, at this point in time, he's gone out into the world. He's seen an enormous amount. He's honed his abilities to observe. He's seen things that were previously things that he'd only known by reading about them. Now, when he returns to the United Kingdom, when he returns to London, in a sense, his physical voyage is over, but his intellectual voyage is just beginning. And to understand what happens next in Darwin's life, we turned actually to a metaphor that comes from the biological sciences, and in particular from animal behavior. What we did was see Darwin as not, let's say, a man in the library, but instead as a bird in a bush. And what I mean by that is if you're a bird in the bush, you're eating the berries in the bush, you're happy. At some point in time, you've eaten so many berries in the bush that you can't find any more. And the question you then have is, do you look for the last berry on that bush, or do you leave that bush and fly somewhere else? And this trade-off between taking what you know you have to hand versus going out to explore to find some new resource that you think might be there but you don't quite know is there, right? How you trade off the certainty of the declining resource you have nearby to the uncertainty of a rich trove somewhere else. This, to the biologist, is known as the exploitation-exploration trade-off. Can you exploit what's local, or can you explore to find something in a new location? And so for Darwin, we see him now not as exploring in physical space, not as traveling the globe, but instead as exploring Victorian science itself. He's ranging over the next 20, 30 years of his life. He's ranging from the geological sciences to the biological sciences. Crucially, as we'll see, he ranges into the economic sciences, into demography. Indeed, he goes into the philosophy of the sciences. He's influenced by a man called William Whewell, who has a theory of how the sciences fit together. And he reads also moral philosophy. He also reads a lot of novels. He reads some Jane Austen, too. But what we're interested in is how he ranges over that entire space, the patterns that he uses to explore what he has to hand.
And so what did you find? It seems like that exploitation, exploiting what you have close to hand, and exploration, which is going further afield to find new things that might not, I mean, in the case of the bird might find berries in the bush they're at. They might find something else to eat if they go a little further afield. So finding kind of the unknown, right, that applies to a lot of things besides just animal foraging. It applies to the artistic process. You might work in one genre of music, and then you start really listening to other things, and huge shifts can happen in the kind of music that you're doing, and those shifts could be very influential. Whatever. With Darwin, like, how do you feel like what he was reading and how he was exploring played out?
So if you're a college student, if you start at university as a freshman, you are encouraged to take a lot of different classes. In a sense, the way we set up, at least in the United States, the way we set up our educational system is to encourage students to explore. Find what you love, take a long time, take a year, 2 years, even 3 years, to see what you like, and then once you know what you like, drill down and do it. And so the way we understand learning, or the way at least we think we understand learning, is that we should begin as explorers and we should end as exploiters. You should fly throughout the forest, right, in this metaphor, you should fly throughout the forest to find the berries you like best and then stay in that bush. When we look at Darwin's process, and in fact, what we do is we literally map the books that he read. We get the full text of the books that he read. We have about 1,000 books in in the particular spam we're interested in. When we map these books onto a semantic space, and so we visualize Darwin's problem now as a truly geometric problem, as a problem of how he literally jumped from one point to another and how we could quantify the distance of those jumps that he made. When we look at that process, what we find is that Darwin begins, and this certainly surprised me, that Darwin begins as an exploiter. He begins as somebody who stays very tightly focused on a subset of all of the books that he is eventually going to read. These books cluster within a very small semantic space.
What were they about?
So a lot of what he's reading at that point are books on geology. He's also reading one of the crucial books that he encounters very early on is a book by Thomas Malthus, and we'll talk a little bit about how Malthus's theories influenced Darwin. But what's fascinating is that Darwin, by and large, is not doing much biology early in his reading career when he gets back from the voyage of the Beagle. So Darwin he's focused on a series of works. He's focused on a semantic space largely defined by, you might say, the really big questions.
What do you mean by semantic space?
So we can talk about two books being different from each other, and there's many ways to do that. I mean, you know, to go very basic, you might say this book is longer than that book. This book was written by a different person. Two books written by the same person, you might say, are similar. So there's many different ways that people have tried to talk about the distance, the intellectual distance you travel from going from one book to another, how they've tried to quantify that in terms of some kind of actual distance, some mathematical quantity that you can say, okay, this book is 12 units from that book, this other book is only 3 units. And so if you read the third book and then the first book, okay, that's just a 3-unit jump. That's a much smaller jump than this more explorative jump if you read the second book that's 12 units away. So people have tried this in different ways, and in fact, in the last couple of years, what makes our research possible is that we think we actually do now have a good way of at least identifying the gross patterns that define what a book is about. We can't get the arguments, but we can get the patterns of words that people use. And what's fascinating, actually, is that the words that you use, the word choices that you make, actually are pretty strongly correlated with the arguments you're going to make anyway. So what we're able to do is look at the pattern of word usage in each of these books, and then we can, having turned a book into a pattern, having turned a book not into an argument that somebody's making, but instead just a pattern of words that he's using, having turned a book into a pattern, then we get all of this mathematical machinery for the comparing and contrasting of patterns. We phrase the pattern now, in fact, in something we call a probability distribution, and we can compare two probability distributions to each other with a set of techniques that we've had, at least in the mathematical sciences, since the 1940s.
When you say semantic space, if I understand you correctly, you mean maybe two books that are about generally the same set of ideas. So you might have two books that are, you know, I'm looking at my own shelf, two books about hiking in the Southwest. They're not exactly about the same thing, but they're in the same space.
Exactly. So if you take those two books, say you take the two books about hiking in the Southwest, and in one sense, they might be very different books, right? One might be written by an environmentalist, one might be written by a hunter, right? But if you look at those two books, they're going to be using very similar words. They're going to use a word like arroyo much more than a book about art history is going to use that word.
Right, exactly. So that's what you mean. Okay, yeah. So going back to Darwin, Darwin was reading books that were in the same general set of topics as you've described, and then something happened and he ventured further afield?
Yes, and in fact, what's remarkable is that we know exactly what happened, which is that Darwin, at this point, has been putting together a theory of gradual change of species characteristics over time. He has all of the pieces that he needs, surprisingly, to teach a class on evolutionary biology as we currently teach it. He has all of the concepts in place, and he's gotten these concepts from this reading that he's done in, you know, the first 10 years that he has after he returns from his voyage. What he doesn't have is the evidence. And this is what has plagued the scientific community for many years. There are many people who privately would say that they share some of Darwin's views. Darwin doesn't really talk about them at this point. He talks about them with people that he knows well. It's still a great taboo to say that you can dispense entirely with the idea of a divine plan when you want to describe the biological world. But at the same time, these ideas are not entirely unforeseen in the intellectual history of the time. The problem is that nobody knows how to prove it. No one knows how to put the evidence together. No one even knows quite where they should look for evidence. And in 1844, a book comes out. It's called Vestiges of Creation. It's published anonymously. We actually know who wrote it. It was a science journalist, a Scottish science journalist called Robert Chalmers. But Vestiges of Creation is the book that Darwin would have written. And it comes out and Darwin is mortified, but he's not mortified because Chalmers got the jump on him. He's mortified because he realizes, thank God I didn't write that book. Chalmers's book has all of the concepts in a proto form. He gets a lot of stuff wrong, but none of the evidence. Chalmers is somebody who believes in phrenology. He has all of these crazy scientific ideas or quasi-scientific ideas that he sort of fits into his account of evolution in order to make it work. So the idea that species change over time, the idea that some of them survive and others don't, this is something, or at least that their properties change over time, this is something that is in Chalmers' book, but Chalmers is also somebody who thinks that insects are made by electricity. Okay, so he's...
Insects are made by electricity.
Yes. So this is one of the...
Okay, that's what you mean by crazy ideas.
Crazy ideas. I mean, and, you know, to be fair, at the time, like, there were a lot of crazy ideas floating around. And, you know, Chalmers is also, he's not a scientist. He's a science journalist. He's somebody who is, you know, wandering around listening to all the things that people who are calling themselves scientists are saying.
Now, does he use the word, I mean, is the word evolution being used at the time?
No, not at all. And in fact, the word evolution does not even appear in the first editions of Origin of Species. Only in the final edition does this word actually appear.
Interesting.
Darwin struggles a great deal with how to describe his theories, what words to use. He comes up with the term natural selection. But over the course of his life, he realizes that this term gets continuously misinterpreted because the question arises, well, who is the selector in this natural selection process? And in fact, he's encouraged to use a very different term coined by Herbert Spencer, which is survival of the fittest, another one that, of course, we hear a great deal about today. So when Darwin sees Vestiges of Creation come out in 1844, as a scientist, he's disgusted. As an author, he's humbled. Because he realizes, well, if I had sat down to put this all together, maybe I wouldn't have made errors as bad as Chalmers did, but I don't have all the pieces that I need. And in fact, one of the professors from his early career at Cambridge that he absolutely loved, Sidgwick was the man who introduced Darwin to the practice of geology, took him on long walks. Sidgwick says, the book is full of moonshine. Mystery and moonshine. And what Chalmers has to do is, in order to tell his story of species change over time, he has to basically invent magical things that happen, scientifically implausible things. This moment when Darwin sees, in some sense, an image, like the ghost of Christmas future, when he sees this, he changes entirely his plan. And he realizes, first of all, that he needs better evidence. Second of all, the controversy, of course, that Vestiges of Creation causes makes him a little gun shy because the book turns out to be published anonymously. No one actually wants to be associated with it. And all of the people he most respects talk about Mr. Vestiges, the mysterious author, as somebody who has essentially committed a scientific crime. Darwin wants to do it right. And what he realizes is that if he's going to do it right, if he's going to put together his theory, he needs more science. In fact, he needs, in some ways, to become the man that he was during his voyage on the Beagle. And now, as an older man in his career now, and strangely enough, after he returns from the voyage on the Beagle, he's fundamentally an ill man for the rest of his life. No one's quite sure why, but from the very vigorous person who's, you know, hiking up, you know, the side of the Andes, when he gets back to England, today we would diagnose him as somebody who had a chronic disease. something like, let's say, lupus. And in fact, people have wondered if Darwin did indeed have lupus. So he needs evidence. He's no longer the vigorous young man who can just go out on another voyage and get it. And so what he does is he turns inward and he begins a long series of studies, in particular on the barnacle, which is this little shellfish that sticks on the side of rocks and on the underside of boats. And he spends the next 10 years of his life, not just on barnacles, but barnacles dominate his research at this point.
And he's got a lot of barnacles.
He has a room where he sits and he does this work, very painstaking work, with the goal of understanding the morphology of the barnacle. Can he see evidence for natural selection? Can he see the heritage? He believes at this point that, you know, any creature that he sees, including humankind, although he's not really willing to say this in print until much later, he sees every creature had to have come from a previous version of itself, and in fact that these versions eventually merged. And so what he's doing is he's looking for the morphological characteristics of within the barnacle that will lend evidence to the book that he's going to write, the book that is going to do what Vestiges wanted to do, but to do it right.
What did Vestiges want to do? What did he want to do?
It's impossible to talk about what we call today the theory of evolution without talking about its religious implications and its political implications. And so when Vestiges of Creation came out, you might say it was a left-wing sensation. Even though the science was a total disaster, Vestiges was saying things that many people wanted to be true. It was saying that there was no divine plan in the biological world, that what we saw in the world around us could be attributed to natural chance and to change, that it was possible for things that appeared to be so fixed for them to actually have changed, to have emerged from something that was very different from what came before. The hawk is a hawk not because God ordained it to be a hawk, but because that hawk emerged, developed, changed out of something very different. And so if you're in the 19th century, you're looking at the emergence of modern capitalism, you're looking at the immiseration of the working class, you're looking at the struggles to make, say, the United Kingdom a true democracy. If Vestiges of Creation comes out and says, you know what, like, nothing in the natural world is ordained by plan. The, you know, king is not king because God ordained him to be king. The queen is not queen because God ordained her to be queen. Instead, in fact, it's all changeable. It's all mutable. Things can progress. This is exciting stuff.
So people want that to be true because they want progress, because they're tired of monarchy, because the working classes want to not suffer the way they're suffering? I mean, these things are all connected.
Exactly. So if you think the plan of the species was laid down by God, then there are natural predators and natural prey. If instead, who becomes a predator and who becomes prey, who becomes the magnificent creature and who does not, if those things are actually the outcome of random gradual events, something that nobody directed and certainly not an all-powerful being directed, if that's the case, well, then everything's up for grabs. You no longer have this kind of platonic image of every unit of society playing the role that they should play. And of course, this is all metaphor, right? The whether or not, you know, God created the animals or not really has no bearing on whether, you know, the slave should be free. But as we all do, we draw our beliefs together. We draw them into a continuous net. And so by challenging the idea that God had laid down a plan for creation, the author Chambers, the author of The Vestiges, was also part of a movement that was challenging the idea that those on top deserved to be on top. So Darwin, you know, to his credit, steered well clear of this. Funnily enough, his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was somebody who had some proto-evolutionary thinking in his own work. Erasmus Darwin was a poet and a philosopher, a very popular man. Today, he would be a public intellectual in the way, let's say, Neil deGrasse Tyson is, or Steven Pinker. But Erasmus Darwin was somebody who realized that something like the transmutation of species, as they called it, the idea that a bird came from something that was not a bird, right? Erasmus realized that that was a very fertile metaphor for talking about how new kinds of technologies could arise, new kinds of social organizations could arise that had not been seen before. If you thought that God had laid out a plan for the species that, in some sense, was finished, you were likely to think that God had laid out a plan for the organization of society, and that was also finished. If you thought that species could change, then you also might think that parliament could change. So when Vestiges of Creation is being written, it's fitting into this intellectual moment. It's incredibly controversial. Everybody's angry. The science is bad. The politics today, most of us would agree the politics are actually pretty good. Like maybe, you should pay members of parliament a salary so that, you could be a member of parliament without actually being independently wealthy. The politics were good. The science was terrible. The controversy was intense, and none of this suited Darwin at all. Because in the end, he was a genial, not quite a Trustafarian. He was somebody who liked the world the way it appeared to him. And his one true goal in life, other than his passion for his wife and his children, his one true goal in life was to do science.
He also had a real aversion to slavery, a kind of disgust for slavery, and an openness to all kinds of people. And one of the things that advanced his work was he was talking to people who were farming and breeding pigeons, and not just other intellectuals and scientists. And through that, he advanced his work. So his good nature and his very open-minded nature seems to be part of not only his personality, but his thinking.
Absolutely. Darwin, in many ways, encapsulates what you might call a form of scientific liberalism, and liberalism in the sort of lowercase, older sense. He was indeed disgusted by slavery. His family had long been an anti-slavery family. His grandfather, Josiah Wedgwood, the manufacturer of China in Britain and where Darwin's fortune came from, was also a passionate advocate against slavery. One of the few conflicts that arose on Darwin's voyage on the Beagle with Captain Fitzroy was, in fact, over slavery. Fitzroy was a man of the old school. He was a Tory. He was right wing. He believed in the, not quite the literal truth of the Bible, but he certainly would not have been a fan of Origin of Species, where Darwin's intellectual life led him. Fitzroy also passionately believed that slavery was a natural form of social organization, something ordained by the very nature of the people who were enslaved. Darwin believed the exact opposite, and in fact, Darwin almost got himself thrown off the voyage of the Beagle. They were in Brazil, and Fitzroy and Darwin were, doing what I guess, gentlemen adventurers did back in the days, which was having dinner at the most important house in the town that they were visiting. In fact, it was one of the big slave estates there at the time. And they began to talk about slavery, and their host said, "Oh, slavery is a natural thing, and in fact, watch this." And so he calls all of his household slaves into the room and says, "Would you all prefer to remain slaves?" And of course, they all say yes. And they're traveling back to the ship that evening, and Fitzroy says, "Well, see, look, it's obvious." And Darwin points out the obvious fact that, of course, none of these people are going to be freed. They know what they have to say, and they lied. And Fitzroy explodes with indignation that Darwin could even think this. And it takes a long time for them to patch up their quarrel on a very confined voyage. So Darwin is constantly somebody, he doesn't get his name in the papers. In fact, the controversy over evolution, it's not one that he participates in publicly. All of the great sort of zingers that are said in favor of evolution against the church, Darwin was the origin of none of them. Darwin is somebody who doesn't want to play a public role, but at the same time, he's somebody that can see perhaps a little bit more clearly than those around him. One of the things that he does, as you note, is he has a very egalitarian attitude towards the origin of scientific information. And so at the same time that he's a member of the Athenaeum, this very prestigious gentleman's club in New York, he's also getting information from pigeon fanciers, from horse breeders, from what today we would call the people most familiar with animal husbandry. Because, of course, we see variation in animal species all around us. We see that apples go from Golden Delicious to Fiji. We see that dogs take on all different shapes and sizes. Everybody saw this at the time. Darwin was wondering, and in The Origin of the Species, he makes the claim that that variation can go beyond the species boundary. And in order to gather that information, he has to do what for many Victorians, certainly of his social class, would have been somewhat unthinkable, which is to get that information from ordinary working men, not people with degrees from prestigious universities.
And these people who were breeding horses or breeding dogs or breeding pigeons were doing artificial selection. They would take a strong member of, a strong stud horse, let's say, and a mare, and breed them for characteristics of horses that they wanted. And so, looking at that, then the leap is to how does nature do this?
Exactly. In fact, the very fact that Darwin centers Origin of Species around this concept of natural selection is in part being driven by the fact that where he's getting a lot of his evidence from, when he's not getting it from his own research, is from people involved in what we would call today artificial selection. Of course, Darwin creates that distinction, which was not there before. Before Darwin comes along, there's just selection. It's just what you do if you want a docile sheep, or sheep with great wool. If you want an intelligent dog, you know what to do. You breed selectively, you pick animals with the traits that you like and breed them together.
And so what happened in nature was nature selected, quote unquote, members of the species that were what, most adapted, most fit?
This is the great puzzle of evolution, which is, what is natural selection selecting for? And Darwin actually got into a lot of trouble because when he wrote Origin of Species at the end of his, or in some sense, at the end of his, the first phase of his intellectual career and the beginning of the second as the originator of this theory, when Darwin wrote that book, he tended to personify natural selection. He tended to say, nature, this being, is picking one thing over another. That's what's leading to the variation that we see. That's what's leading in the end to the development and the transmutation, the change that we see in species. Over the course of his life, Darwin regretted saying it that way, and he came to settle upon a phrase that was suggested by a younger friend of his, Herbert Spencer, which was survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest isn't much better, and the reason it isn't much better is, well, what's fit? What does fittest mean? How do we know what's fittest? And you very quickly discover that, of course, what you mean there is a tautology. The survival of the fittest means the survival of those who are most likely to survive. And so, for much of the career, the early career of evolution, people struggled with how to understand selection. We know what it means when a farmer selects a sheep to have good wool. He has a set of goals in mind. But how do we understand what it means to say a species has been selected when there's no goal for that selection?
Well, and there's no selector.
And there's no selector. And since once there's a selector, then you're all set, because then the selector has goals and your job is to figure them out. That's natural theology. Then you say, lo and behold, how creative the selector was to produce this apple, how creative the selector was to produce a hawk or an owl. If you look at Darwin's experience in his life, and you read what he writes in The Origin of the Species when he is at his most personal, what Darwin is really fascinated by is diversity. What strikes him about the natural world is not, today we'd say, not how well adapted it is. What struck Darwin was how many different kinds of things there were. And in the end, the piece that Darwin had, and we've been filling in the blanks of this story for centuries after, the piece that Darwin had, the insight that you might say was the most idiosyncratic, the most personal, goes all the way back to his youth when he was traveling through the wilds of Scotland on hikes, and then when he's doing the same thing in Argentina. What strikes you is the, or what struck him was the fact that there were so many different kinds of things. That there were not just worms, but there were also lichens. There were not just lichens, but there were also fish. There were not just fish, but there were also crabs. The incredible number of things that happen. And so, in fact, Darwin spends a lot of his time talking about selection or trying to figure out how the process that he has some kind of handle on, not how it's going to make a totally awesome animal, not how it's going to make the best animal, not how it's going to make the sort of fittest animal even. That was Spencer's phrase. The word fittest was Spencer's phrase. For Darwin, it's the question of how do we get so many animals to begin with?
And that's a question that's still being asked.
Absolutely. It's one insight into it. In fact, the way we teach evolution, or at least a sort of high school biology textbook way of teaching it, in some sense, it kind of misses the spirit of what Darwin did, because we tend to focus on what we call microevolution, the very slow change in a single species. What Darwin was really interested in was how species radiate, how they diverge, how they create new variations of themselves that become increasingly distant. He actually saw this over and over again, certainly in South America. He saw this. There's a lovely analogy that some writers have made in Darwin's work. They've pointed out that at the same time that Darwin was building his theory of evolution after he got back from the voyage of the Beagle, at the same time he was doing that, the Victorian world that he lived in was seeing an explosion, not of biological diversity, but of technological diversity. This was the first explosion of new tools, new machines, new devices that nobody had ever seen before. There were far more things in the shops that you could buy than had ever been there even 20 or 15 years ago. In fact, when he got back, just for 5 years absence, when he got back from his voyage, he came to a Britain that had been totally transformed. The railroads had spread even further. Lanes that he would have seen carts on were now actually turned into railroads. So Darwin is building a theory. He's trying to explain the diversity he sees in the biological world. What he's surrounded by, funnily enough, is an explosion of cultural and technological diversity as well.
That work in similar ways?
Well, so this is a challenge. Until late in his life, Darwin never really wanted to talk too much about culture. And he never wanted to talk about what humans did. In Origin of Species, certainly in the first editions, he steers very clear of getting into the question of where did humans come from. He doesn't want to touch it. He'll bring in some biological examples from humans. I think he may even talk about the appendix, something we have, which we no longer need. And it's a great example of evolution in action, how it just sort of leaves things behind. But Darwin is very reluctant to connect the dots until many, many years after Origin of Species has come out. And so while these thoughts may have occurred to him as he was writing The Origin, he may have thought and may have perceived that the free market competition all around him, not just for wages, but also for new technologies and new techniques, that may have had an impact. It's not something that he writes about explicitly in Origin of Species. Now, the parallel you might make is to one of Darwin's very early influences, which was the Reverend Thomas Malthus. Malthus provides a key point for Darwin, a key brick in Darwin's edifice, which is the idea that as populations grow, food becomes more scarce. And for Malthus, in fact, Malthus was a demographer. He was somebody who worked for the British Colonial Service, in fact. Malthus saw that basically, and it's a very sort of negative way to view the world, it's in many ways a sort of a very nihilistic way to view the world. And Malthus says essentially, look, you know, there are starving people in the world. The poor don't have enough to eat. But if you give them food, all they'll do is have more children. And in fact, their children will be even worse off than they are because there'll be more people to feed and the food will not have grown enough to keep them up. And in fact, for Malthus, it was the lust of the working class that kept them immiserated.
Miserable?
Yes, exactly. So Darwin encounters Malthus's book very early, and just a few years after he comes back from his voyage in the Beagle. Malthusian ideas are in the air. The idea that populations will continue to grow until a point of maximum misery is reached, where children are dying fast enough that the population no longer grows. Darwin took these ideas to heart. What's amazing is that Darwin, in some sense, found the Malthusian loophole. For Malthus, the world was a story of complete stasis. Occasionally, there might be a new resource that was discovered, a new continent opened, a new form of food found. But in general, what would happen is that populations would grow until they reached the point of maximum carrying capacity and then stay there. What Darwin did is he took from Malthus the idea of competition. He took very seriously the fact that the biological world was a nasty place, that it was a world of war. He doesn't use Tennyson's phrase "red in tooth and claw," but it certainly appears, those ideas appear in Origin of the Species. So Darwin takes from Malthus the idea that life is struggle and strife, but the loophole that he discovers is that among that struggle and strife, there is also variation, that there are new solutions to that struggle being found. And when new solutions are found, new ways to find food, a new source of shelter for an animal, let's say, the variants that discover that begin to succeed the ones who do not. And so, in a sense, he found the loophole in Malthus in a very similar way, perhaps, that the Victorians found the loophole in Malthus's arguments for their own social development. It was, in the end, social innovation coupled with a drastic rise in technology that enabled the Victorian working class and middle classes to become, as certainly in a relative sense, as successful as they were by the end of that century.
When you talk about that, what I think about is the world that we're living in today, where we're seeing population explosion, a real limitation on arable land, climate change, desertification, and applying that Malthusian idea to what we're seeing seems to a lot of people to be completely valid, right? I mean, unless we think that we're going to find colonization on Mars or ways to grow huge amounts of food in your basement, you know, or something like that. It's tricky not to see the world that way. And the people who say, oh, well, we'll find something, we'll figure it out. I mean, maybe that's more true to Darwin's way of thinking, but.
So, in a sense, the intellectual battles of Darwin's time continue for us. And I don't just mean the debate about whether to teach evolution, but exactly this question you bring up, which is how much change can the world support? It's natural for us to look at the world as it is today, this minute, and to think either that this is the final stage that we will ever be at, or perhaps to think that, you know, depending on the kind of person you are, this is the natural stage for us to be at. So there are many people who will say, yes, you know, history has been driving to this final culmination of liberal democracy and free markets for the last 50,000 years. Here we are. It's probably not going to change that much more. Those ideas are always there. They were there in Darwin's time. Whether those ideas are phrased in an optimistic sense or a pessimistic sense depends, I think, upon the character of the person. What Darwin asked us to do, and he was drawing on a intellectual tradition that he had put together himself. This is, of course, his reading pattern. What he did was read people like Lyell and put together a story of what happens when gradual change refuses to stop accumulating. A mountain can rise inch by inch if you give it enough time. Now, it's important to note, Darwin was not a believer in progress. He did not think that evolution was driving towards some beautiful future. His grandfather did, actually. His grandfather wrote these great books that had sort of proto-evolutionary ideas, but they stuck in this kind of teleology that the world was all going to get better and better and better, and everything was going to be fine. Like, don't worry. You know, as long as, you know, certain political changes were made. Darwin was not somebody who would have said, don't worry about climate change, it's all going to be okay. He's not somebody who would have said, don't worry about deserts. He certainly understood how terrifying the natural world could be. He, you know, survived earthquakes, he survived storms, he survived not having enough food in you know, on his travels. He survived, you know, missing the shipment that was going to save him. So Darwin was not a foolish optimist. The one thing he did challenge us to do was to consider the effect of the slow, almost invisible accumulation of gradual change. It's, in a sense, we had all been in the museum.
we had all been looking at the paintings, and it was Darwin who was the first to point out that if you looked closely enough, the paintings were changing. But you had to look for a very long time to see them.
How was Origin of Species received when it was published, both by the general public, by the church, by their scientists?
It was going to be a bombshell, whatever happened. Darwin was aware of the vestiges of creation scandal, so his evidence was solid. And in fact, many of the early reviewers said, you know, we could have done with a little less biology, Mr. Darwin. So he had built a case. It was a case that he was able to build in part from the readings that he did after Vestiges came out. But at the same time, everything was there that was going to overturn the apple cart. Two things he skipped. He did not talk about the very origin of life. So in one sense, Origin of Species is the book that never does what its title promises to do. He talked only about the creation of new species from ones that came before. He never really talked about how, you know, what was the sort of origin moment. And the other thing he didn't do, and this is another attempt, I think, to dodge the theological challenges that he was going to get, was that he didn't really talk about the origin of man. But at the same time, the ideas that Darwin had now given credibility to, those ideas were in the air. And so very quickly people were asking, well, you know, Mr. Darwin, are you descended from a monkey on your grandfather's side or your grandmother's side? So all of the people that you would expect would like the book, the people who saw a biological theory of evolution as supporting their own desires for social progress, they loved it, right? Remarkably, a large number of the clergy, well, certainly more than you would expect, liked the book. And this is in part because Darwin was a reasonably conservative writer, at least when it came to the more radical implications of evolution. It was also because religion itself had changed in the last few decades since he came back from his voyage. Priests, the clergy, were now more willing to accept the idea that maybe God's job was, you know, create the universe. Not sure I care about that. Really, God was going to be more important because of the personal relationship that he had to you. We were seeing this transformation of religion from being a set of stories that supported the social order, a set of stories that told you things about where everything came from and why the people in power were the people in power. Religion was changing from that model to a model where it was much more about self-improvement, much more about self-help, much more about being a good person, and much more about, and this is a phrase that will sound familiar to Americans, much more about the personal relationship you might have with your Savior, Jesus Christ. And so, in fact, that actually made them more able to accept Darwin's theory of evolution, because if it wasn't that important who created the species, then, well, here's this beautiful book. It's extremely well argued. He doesn't tell you that people are not divine, because Darwin doesn't really touch on that, although, again, read between the lines. He doesn't tell you anything that's going to harm someone's own self-image. And so more clergy than would be expected actually either defended Darwin's book or at least refused to condemn it. That said, there were many people who were very strongly invested in a model of the world where everything about them bore the traces of God's power. And those people began the attack almost immediately.
And that attack is still going on.
The attack is still going on. Darwin himself worried a great deal about what his theory would do for people's emotional lives and for their moral lives. Because Darwin was someone for whom morality came naturally. He was not a tortured man. One of the things that he worried a great deal about was the effect that it had on his wife, Emma. And in fact, Emma was a religious woman. She was until the end of her life. And she asked him at some point in time whether or not this theory meant that they would not be reunited in heaven together. And so that was something that Darwin took seriously, not in his capacity as a scientist, but certainly in his capacity to understand the human mind, to understand that the stories that we tell ourselves are not just explanations of the natural world, but also situate us in a meaning-making process. The simpler way to say it is, when we look at the Sandia Mountains during a sunrise, we feel emotions that are profoundly unscientific. When we think about somebody we love, when we think about an animal we love, when we think about creatures that a scientist would say are just simply blind products of evolution, we don't feel that way, and we probably shouldn't. And so Darwin, I think in part, one of the reasons that he refused to get into the absolute knockdown fights, I mean, great zingers, right? So it was not Darwin who was asked this, but it was his friend Thomas Huxley, who was asked by the Archbishop in a major debate in front of the British Association of Science, the famous question, who are you descended from, sir? Is the monkey on your grandfather's side or your grandmother's side? It was Huxley who famously replied, I would rather be descended from a miserable monkey than a man like you. And he goes on to say, a man like you who would interject such levity in a serious scientific discussion, right? Darwin had, he never got involved in this. And we talked a little bit earlier in this interview about the fact that when Darwin came back from the Beagle, and over the course of his life, he was a much frailer man. He was a man constantly beset by illness, a man who for many years couldn't leave his house or travel very far because he was constantly sick. Nobody knows why Darwin was sick. We have no good evidence for any kind of physiological illness. There are some theories that he picked up something called Chagas's disease when he was traveling in South America, but the etiology of the disease doesn't work out. He probably didn't have that. We have no idea why Darwin, for days on end, couldn't get out of bed, was vomiting into a trough. We don't know why. One of the explanations is that he struggled psychologically with the implications of what he found. That he was actually torn by the experience of, as far as he could tell, putting the capstone on a theory that denied the presence of divine plan, but at the same time being unwilling, as a fundamentally conservative person, being unwilling to adjust himself to the very findings that he was going to make famous.
Do you think that the emotions, the unscientific emotions, as you put it, that we feel when we watch the Sandia Mountains at sunset, or the way we feel about our animals or about each other, are themselves a product of evolution?
One of Darwin's colleagues, and in fact a man who, to Darwin's surprise, wrote a book that was almost exactly the book that Darwin was going to write and did it right. This is a man called Alfred Wallace. Wallace was unwilling to extend evolution to humankind. For Wallace, the experiences that man had maybe in part were products of biology, but there was something supernatural added to mankind. He says that, you know, the monkeys made this first leap into humanhood, but after that something else happened that gave them a special spiritual characteristic. In Darwin's writings, and in fact he wrote on this many years after The Origin of Species, Darwin absolutely denies this. He says that the emotions that you have, the expressions on your face, and famously his last book was The Expression of Emotions in Man and the Animals. He denied that any of these had origins outside of the evolutionary process, that the love that you felt, the smile that you saw on someone else's face, that these were genetically linked to the grins that a monkey makes. Darwin was adamant that there was no spiritual quality super added to mankind. Now, whether or not that makes the emotion you feel in the presence of natural beauty or human beauty, whether that makes that emotion less or more, is really up to you. You could see it in, I would say, two very different ways. Certainly, the way many people saw it was to say that Darwin has diminished us, that the spiritual feeling that I have upon seeing I mean, the landscapes we certainly have here in the American Southwest, that spiritual feeling, Darwin says, it's no more than a squawking bird. But another way to look at it, and this is a way I do feel it myself, is the experiences I have in those situations become even greater now. Because instead of being some sort of fluctuation in my own mind, it's now a fluctuation that's connected to 5 billion years of biological and natural evolution. The emotion I have is the product of every single predecessor I've had going all the way back into the sponges. And to me, that's amazing that I'm not only connected to this landscape by being in this landscape, but that the very experiences I have are as majestic as the landscape itself. No one thinks a mountain is smaller because there's no blueprint for it. No one thinks a mountain requires a designer to be the mountain that it is, and I don't think that my emotions require the same designer to have or to deserve the respect they get and to have the meaning that they do.
Simon DeDeo is an external faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute and professor at Carnegie Mellon. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.